You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hey, out there in archaeology podcast land, this is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're going to be broadcasting Rock Art Episode 50. With Paku Yang. She is a cultural and social anthropologist hailing from the Hmong people. She's going to talk a bit about her culture, about shamanism, animism, and the nature of ceremony and ritual elements of her culture. Well, welcome everyone in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel with your Rock Art Podcast, episode number 50. Can you imagine? 50 episodes so far. What a remarkable legacy. And we are honored and blessed to be speaking with Paku Yang, who is a young woman who's a socio and cultural anthropologist that works with me in one of my associations. And she's going to grace our humble interaction here and share with you a bit about her background, about the nature of her ethnicity, and how that relates to both the world of shamanism and the world of art, iconography, and all things, signatures that relate to the identification of our people. Paku, are you with us?
I am here. I'm very excited to be here. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Well, as we said, I'm honored and blessed. I guess the million-dollar question I always open it up with is, tell us a bit about your background and how you made it into social and cultural anthropology, given your sort of hailing from another part of the globe, aren't you?
That is correct. I feel like for most people around my age, I'm turning 25 in October here now. I feel like most people my age, especially from my ethnicity, we oftentimes lose our really deep connection with our cultural side. I know quite a few of my friends that I went to school with, I would say they're not quite in tune with their traditional side as I am. And it's not a personal thing. I feel like it's a sense of how they grew up and how their family accepted the whole transition of being refugees and being immigrants. So for me personally, my family, we actually were one of the later families to come to the U.S. compared to the earlier families.
Tell us first where you hail from and what culture you come from.
My family is Hmong. My family is actually from a refugee camp in Thailand, originally from Laos. They immigrated here from Thailand in 1992, I believe. And I was born in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. But originally, my family was actually sponsored to come to the U.S. to California first. And they moved to Massachusetts because another church actually sponsored them to move to Massachusetts to help support them there as well. So I was born and raised in Massachusetts until about the age of 8 or 9. And that was when my family moved back to California. And that was kind of where I was a lot more exposed to a lot more people in my background, because I felt like in Massachusetts, I was surrounded by people that I went to church with. And there wasn't a very large Hmong community that I felt like I connected with there. There was still a concentration of Hmong people in the town that I grew up in Massachusetts, but not quite to the extent that I felt here in Fresno, California. So when I moved to Fresno, California here, it was kind of like a culture shock for me in the sense that there was so many more people like me and I was not expecting it as a kid. And when I was moving here from Massachusetts, I was expecting it to be the same. I was expecting to, you know, have all of these people supporting me in like all of these different aspects like school and church and all that. But when I moved to Fresno, California, there was such a higher concentration of these immigrants that I was going to school with. It was sort of like everyone was sort of in their own world at this point because everyone was trying to figure out where their place in the world was, you know? And I felt like as a kid, that's where what we were all trying to go through, trying to figure out where we were in the world.
So give us a thumbnail sketch of what you know about the life in your homeland, what language was spoken, what was the, you know, economic basis, how many people lived there, you know, just sort of a word picture of quickly who the Hmong are and what they relate to in terms of their culture.
So for the Hmong people in particular, it's actually a very broad term. There's actually multiple different dialects of Hmong, and there's very many different names for Hmong people throughout China and Southeast Asia. I know that a lot of people mistake it, obviously, with Mongolian, which is actually, some people find it kind of offensive because traditionally in China, they had another name for Hmong people, and it was kind of like a culture of the Miao people. And it's a little bit different than the Hmong people, but it kind of started having a negative connotation with that name. And it was kind of associated with the word barbarian, pretty much. So a lot of Hmong people will be offended if you kind of associate them with the wrong type of calling. So that's just with the names in particular.
And what part of that territory did you live in?
So my family was from Laos and Thailand. My parents met in Laos, and then after the Vietnam War, they actually fled to Thailand, where they lived in a refugee camp for around 10 years or so.
Oh, my word. Wow.
Yeah, they lived there for quite a long time before they were actually allowed to the U.S. because I believe it was around 1980 that families were actually allowed to come to the U.S. Before that, around 1975 was when Hmong families that were actually involved with General Vang Pao, who was, you know, associated with the U.S. military, in 1975, that's when people that were actually in the military with the United States, they were able to come through the military. But before that, 1980 was about the time that families actually started going over. So my family, since we came in the 1990s, we're still considered a family that kind of came pretty later on in the whole refugee scene.
And what was the traditional lifeway of the Hmong? How did they live?
So traditionally for Hmong people, most of us will consider ourselves the hill people or hill tribes, mm-hmm, because they're more used to living in the higher elevation mountains, living in the jungles, kind of being self-sustaining. They grew crops, they raised their own animals, they hunted for their own food. And this is pretty common for most Hmong people, but I know that since our people originally hail from southern China, mm-hmm, I know that there are so many different Hmong types of Hmong in China. And I know that there's roughly 10 million people that associate themselves with being some type of Hmong. And I don't quite remember what all of the names are because there's so many different people in China, in particular, just China, that when they do take the census and they do select themselves as being Hmong, it's not always blatant that they're Hmong.
So your ancestry was hill person. You were agriculturalist. What were the main crops? And you said you also did some hunting. You also had that sort of forager and agricultural level of living, correct?
That is correct.
And what were your main crops and what were the main domestic animals?
For main domestic animals, I would definitely say, well, I would say that my family, when they lived in the refugee camps, they, with the other families, they raised pigs and chickens. It was very rare to have a cow, but if you had a cow, it was, you know, a pretty good sign of wealth and longevity there, you know. Mm-hmm. So having a cow was still very good, but it wasn't common.
And what was the religion that was practiced at that time?
Well, Hmong people practice shamanism, but yes, it actually also stems from an old type of animism where they believe that, you know, like all animals have spirits and humans are intermingled with those spirits as well. So our shamanism is still very spiritually connected to animal spirits as well, not just human spirits.
And it sounds like it's a very active and vibrant religion. Am I correct?
It is very vibrant. I would say it is very vibrant. It is very, very interactive. Yes, it is. It is very, I would say in modern culture today, it is very progressive. They are mm-hmm. willing to work with, you know, with modern medicine. I know that a lot of more traditional families that, you know, their older relatives, as they become, you know, more hospitalized, they're becoming more accepting of, you know, combining modern medicine with their rituals and kind of meeting halfway for like a compromise in order to, you know, try to save their loved ones while still trying to stick to their traditions.
Yes. What language group is your native language? How is it affiliated with other Hmong peoples? What particular classification is it?
So my family in particular, we are Hmong De, which if translated to English is white Hmong.
Okay.
And for the Hmong language, it actually depends on the dialect kind of depends on the clan that you associate yourself with. And certain clans will associate themselves with a certain dialect as well. And the dialect mostly comes from the region that you're from. And that region, the women actually wear specific colored clothing and types of clothing. So Hmong De people, we wear a very specific outfit for ceremonies and social gatherings as compared to the green Hmong, which we call, or the blue Hmong, we call them Hmong Leng, which is different. And they definitely do, when we speak Hmong, we definitely can hear the different dialects. And there are a couple other dialects.
Is it mutually intelligible dialects? Can you understand one another?
I believe that if you're fluent in Hmong, in white Hmong or green Hmong, you should be able to understand both of them. But if you're not very fluent in it, it is very easy to not understand.
I see.
The other dialect. But I feel like most people that are fluent with it are based on context clues as well. It's very easy because most of the words are pretty similar.
So do those many millions of Hmong people speak roughly the same languages or different dialects? They're all somehow linguistically related and ethnically connected?
Definitely. The Hmong language in particular is very much based on the tones and the letters. It's obviously been romanized, but the letters of the Hmong alphabet, at the end of the word, it really does depend on how you end the word. The tone at the end of the word really determines the meaning of that word. For instance, we have one word for six different meanings. We have J. And those are all different words. You know, one word means salt, one word means fish, one word means smart. And it really depends on the ending note of that word. And it's different tones.
Boy, I bet it would be a tough language to learn for anyone of sort of, you know, the English background. That's phenomenal, though.
I would say Hmong is a fairly easy language to learn in the sense that it doesn't have any conjugation. There's no conjugating any words. The words stay the same.
Oh, my word. Okay, I didn't know. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's rather exciting. Very different. Very, very different. Well, give us a glimpse of where we're going to go with this discussion, I guess. I think we need a kind of a better understanding of kind of what the Hmong culture is and the relationship of shamanism and also the relationship of sort of the textiles and the symbolism and how that all works. One of the reasons I'm interviewing Paku is because I think it would be fascinating to see about the comparison between the shamanism that you've talked about and even the traditional shamanism in California Indians. And I think I would not be very surprised to know that there's a tremendous amount of parallelism between those two, sort of cosmologies or religious metaphors. And you probably know that being a social and cultural anthropologist, I know that is of great interest to you, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I really do believe that there is quite a great connection between shamanism in California and the Hmong culture.
Let's talk about that in the next segment, but I think that'll be fabulous. Thank you, Paku. I'll pick it up on the flip-flop. Welcome back to the second segment of the Rock Art Podcast with Paku Yang and Dr. Alan Garfinkel. This is your Rock Art Podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Paku is of the Hmong background, and she's also a cultural and social anthropologist and has quite a unique background and interest and knowledge about her culture. Paku, we were just getting into sort of beginning to talk about shamanism and arts and symbology and how that in fact is rather parallel to some of the Native American religious views as well. Maybe you can talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so I'll just jump right into it. So the Hmong religion, I guess, like I said earlier, it did come from an animism belief in that the spirit world is interconnected through all living things. So in the Hmong culture, for shamanism, we have specific people. We call them Zining, which is a shaman, master of spirits. And this can be a man or a woman. And humans are able to be hosts to multiple spirits and multiple souls. And we do believe that, you know, the soul is integral in somebody's life, in their longevity in particular. And, you know, being frightened or your soul can be kidnapped, things like that can affect your soul and it can in turn affect your health physically. So just in particular with the shaman master, which we call the Zining, when they're doing certain rituals to, you know, bring back souls or go looking for lost souls, they do go into a type of trance where they don't always take a medicinal herb to kind of get into that trance. Sometimes they do. It depends on the shaman. Depends on the shaman, on the spirit master. It depends on them. But most of the time, they don't need to. But they will go into a trance. And most of the time, they do this by getting on, like, a flying... When I translate it in my head, it's a flying horse. But in reality, it's actually just a wooden bench. That's about about a human length, I'd say. And they're able to travel through the spirit world on that. That's their transportation in order for them to fly and look for what they're looking for. And that can be looking for a person that's already deceased, like their soul, and trying to communicate with them, or looking for the soul of somebody that is sick and they're doing the ceremony for them. It can be just to like be looking for reasons for specific events. And I feel like I do kind of see that kind of symbolism in California, like rock art specifically. You know, we do see
very definitely
symbolism like that in rock art. Yeah.
Well, when you've mentioned specifically, again, using altered states of consciousness or trances, either taking a psychotropic or some sort of ethnobotanical, or just doing it from vision questing or meditation.
Correct.
Or imagining or using your mind to then travel on some sort of a spiritual connection. To talk about the animals that one might ride to ascend to some sort of a spirit realm and commune with the ancestors or certain spirits or certain deities, etc. Amongst the people of Baja California, their shamans would actually ascend to the sky and bring down the people who had passed on. and would actually allow the people to then speak to them or connect with them in a ceremonial way. And that seems to have, again, some parallels, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And for Hmong people, something that I see in, you know, and even in like modern ghost stories, I kind of see some kind of like connection there, because for Hmong people, we strongly believe that, you know, if you were really close with a loved one and they pass on and their spirit has a hard time letting go of you in the living world, their spirit can linger and their spirit can affect your spirit and your health in real life. So I think that's actually pretty common in ghost stories, where, you know, people say they have, you know, unfinished business, as I would say. In shamanism, we believe that does happen, where, you know, loved ones do have unfinished business with loved ones. And the reason someone is feeling sick is because they have unfinished business with a loved one that passed away, stuff like that. So that's pretty interesting. And just referring back to animals, and Hmong people actually do sacrifices as well.
When someone becomes a shaman, or, you know, some sort of a native doctor, how often does that occur? Is that very a popular niche, or is it something rather special? Have you experienced, you know, those curing and association ceremonies with them?
So to become a shaman, it is actually a pretty rare thing for someone to become a shaman. I know that most people, they're born into it. Like, ever since they're children, their parents just know that they have a spiritual connection. That's either, you know, just by them knowing certain things that they're not supposed to know, or just having a lot more insight than most people their age do. Like, being a shaman, it's kind of like a thing that they believe you're really born with. And you can become a shaman. And in most cases, those people that become shamans later in their life usually become shamans because of some kind of, you know, event that was really traumatizing to them. And that event caused their soul to become extremely connected with the spiritual world. And in that case, then
fascinating.
That somehow had them stay connected to the spiritual world. So
have you experienced some of those ceremonies that have been led by shamans to heal or to speak with the dead or to connect with some sort of a higher power?
Oh yeah, definitely. So I would say that my mother is pretty progressive. She doesn't always follow the traditional ceremonies that I would say my family should have gone through. And I don't blame her. It was more of, since I would say my culture is sort of like a patriarchal culture. After my father passed away, my family didn't really stay that close with my father's side of the family. And so I feel like my family kind of missed out on a lot of that kind of important ceremonies. But I do still participate in a lot of them, just because of Hmong culture, since everyone here specifically in the culture is so intermingled. Just knowing other Hmong families, they will invite you to join their family in these types of ceremonies. And distant cousins as well. Like, in the Hmong culture specifically, having a specific last name ties you to that last name spiritually. So any other Hmong person with the last name Yang, I'm some way, somehow, spiritually down the line, tied to their family no matter what, until I get married. If I get married and my last name changes, my spirit immediately becomes that family's, goes to that family's spiritual line. But in particular, I know a lot of Hmong people with the last name Yang, and in a sense, we are spiritually connected through that family, and so we are invited to lots of different types of ceremonies. And I've been to lots of funerals, lots of spirit callings, and the difference between spirit callings and funerals is, obviously, a funeral is a funeral, and then a spirit calling is more of like for situations, in the sense that for either someone is sick, or someone is having a celebration, they want loved ones to, they need loved ones to be there to, you know that they're going through this experience.
So they're calling on the ancestors.
Correct. So they're calling on their ancestors to be there. Most of the time, spirit callings are for people who are either experiencing some kind of illness, some kind of unexplained event or unexplained illness, like I said, but I've never experienced anything supernatural in like the modern sense of supernatural. Mm-hmm. But when I do go to the ceremonies and I see the shamans doing their specific techniques, such as like the, we have a specific technique of shamanism, of the shaman master finding their way through the spirit world, and that is through throwing down a split horn.
Uh-huh.
And depending on how the horn lands, it tells them what direction to go. And it's kind of crazy because you think, wow, he's just kind of like throwing this in a random fashion. He's kind of just going about. But when it comes down to it, when you know that they're asking a specific question and they're predicting the exact way that the horn is going to land, it's kind of spine tingling when it lands exactly the way he lands, you know, 10 times in a row or like 20 times in a row. And it's like, uh-huh. Well, I wasn't expecting that, uh-huh. But it could have been pure chance, you know, but, right. What, but there are some cases where I really do, you know, believe that this is all really happening, you know, like.
What sort of regalia or costume does the spirit master typically wear? Is there a special costume or?
There is actually. So for the, if I recall, they wear a very simple outfit. Usually mm-hmm. it's all black, and I believe they will wear a belt. Mm-hmm. I believe the belt is supposed to be red. Okay. And I do believe that belt is actually supposed to help tie them, keep them tied to the spiritual realm, but I'm mm-hmm. not quite sure on that, sure. One. And they wear actually a cloth over the face, almost like a blind to cover their face. And
so they wear some sort of a veil.
Yeah. I my mother told me about why they wear that, but I can't quite recall.
I think it's rather common amongst shamans. I've seen that done rather often, even cross-culturally throughout the world, is that often they'll, yeah, have something across their face. Now, to sort of move off that realm slightly, what sort of religious ceremonies and rituals have you attended? And what is there particular clothing that's associated with those special events?
Yeah, so I guess if we want to kind of transition for funerals in particular, we have like completely different clothing we wear from, say, like a wedding or a festival.
Mm-hmm.
A funeral, you're actually going to wear more simple clothing, and that's usually just black cloth. And for the person in particular that the funeral is for, that person is, especially if they're an older person who's passing on, they're actually supposed to be layered with multiple, I only know the Hmong name for it, but yeah, I'm not quite sure how to translate it into English. I'd say they're kind of like robes,
mm-hmm.
but they're actually supposed to be hand sewn by the family, by the daughters, I believe, of the family.
And it's layered clothing.
Correct. It's actually just like multiple layers of robes. And I know that anybody can make it for the deceased person, like any family can make it for them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, sometimes these bodies can weigh way, way more than they are expected to. Like, they can weigh up to like hundreds of pounds because they're putting so many layers of clothing on them.
Oh, my word.
Huh. Yeah, so they're actually quite heavy.
And on those garments, are there images, you know, or particular designs identified?
There are. Some of them are embroidered. They're much more simple than our traditional, like, ceremonies, okay, like, yeah, weddings and stuff like that. They're a lot more plain. They're mostly supposed to be like a hemp type of textile.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I can't quite recall what the technique is called, but there's a technique of dyeing where they use wax to create certain designs, and then they dye it and they melt the wax off. And it has a specific type of design based on the dye.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty common for just the funeral attire for the deceased person.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular for funerals, for people who are attending funerals, I know in modern culture nowadays, we kind of just wear the modern clothing that you would wear to a funeral. But and for the Hmong culture, you would typically wear,
yeah,
your everyday wear, which is in Hmong culture, it was pretty bland for us. But for specifically for ceremonies such as we would call it Mapecho, which is like celebrating the new year, or Chong, which is getting married, we do wear quite bright and festive clothing, and that does involve, you know, doing embroidery, which is very meticulous, you know, needlework, and it doesn't have to be symbolic. It's not always symbolic. It's actually supposed to be kind of ambiguous and kind of open to interpretation, but it is very colorful with lots of bright greens, bright reds, bright blues, bright, and even incorporating the whites and the orange and all that. For Hmong clothes in particular, they do like, I'm not sure when this started, but I'm sure back in the day they used kind of like bells or pieces of metal to decorate their clothing. But nowadays in modern culture, if you go to these types of celebrations like the Hmong celebrations and whatnot, they actually hang their clothing with beads and coins, like silver coins.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And, you know, it's very loud. And yeah. And my mother, when she's doing it, when she buys those coins for making this Hmong traditional clothes, she's looking for the sound that the coins make.
Really?
If they don't make a nice and clear ringing sound, she doesn't buy them. She always wants to find coins that make a very nice sound when you're moving. Because the sound that the coins make when they're rubbing around all the beads and stuff like that, it's supposed to be attractive, you know?
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of tune that the coins want to make when you're wearing them. And that's also kind of like a symbol of, you know, your wealth. So the more coins you have on your clothes, the more beads and clothes you have, things you have with
Wonderful.
Your vests and all the bags that you have on you,
it's
just a better symbolism of your wealth when you're out celebrating. Because during
Wonderful.
That time is also a time where Hmong people are supposed to be finding their significant other. They're supposed to be courting.
Yeah, they're happy and they're celebrating. Well, let's on this last segment sort of segue off into some deeper realms of the Hmong life ways. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Hey, gang, this is Dr. Alan Garfinkel with your Rock Art Podcast, episode 50, and we're down to segment 3 in the final flare here. We've got Piku Yang, she's Hmong, and a social and cultural anthropologist, talking about what it's like to be of that ethnicity and culture, and thinking about the way in which you think of the world and celebrate and identify with the Hmong culture. Piku, you're going to give us a bit of a case study and drop us into one of your favorite celebrations, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely. So I'd say my favorite Hmong celebration would definitely be the Hmong New Year.
Mm-hmm.
And we call that the Napekyo, which is, you know, kind of a celebration of the new year, you know, this end of the season, the new season coming in.
Mm-hmm.
In Fresno, well, in California in particular, we host the largest Hmong New Year in the world, and we actually call it the Hmong International New Year, and we actually have Hmong people come from all over the world to actually come celebrate the celebration here in Fresno. It's actually at the Fresno Fairgrounds every year. Well, obviously not the last year because of COVID. Hopefully this year, if things go well, they'll host it again, but it's normally at the Fresno Fairgrounds, and
So what goes on is
it is a pretty lucrative business opportunities, especially for Hmong people who are running businesses. There's lots of food vendors. There's lots of vendors who actually just sell Hmong goods. Sometimes these vendors are coming from out of the country to sell their goods here. So they'll be selling, say, movies or videos from Laos and Thailand that are kind of nostalgic for the Hmong people here who grew up in Laos or Thailand, who, you know, kind of have that longing for their homeland. That's actually a pretty lucrative business for the Hmong New Year's, is selling videos and things like that. And I know that in the more modern age, people are more able to just go on YouTube and look up those videos, but that is still a very lucrative business at the Hmong New Year. There's also, you know, clothing vendors who sell lots of traditional types of clothing, and that is a very, very lucrative business to have there, because some people, obviously, traditional Hmong clothes are supposed to be handmade by the mother or the wife or, you know, a family member. But in modern times, not everyone has that time and not everybody has that patience or the skill to do that. And so that's actually a pretty big business at the Hmong New Year. There's lots of vendors selling all types of traditional Hmong clothing. And sometimes they're actually pretty modern. They've tried to put modern spins on them. So you'll see lots of different types of outfits that, you know, fit different people and have different styles. Some are inspired by American style. Some are inspired by Chinese style, like more Chinese styles, more, you know, just all kinds of beautiful Hmong clothing there. But they all kind of have the same embroidery aspect to it. There's lots of embroidery. There's also lots of different specific colors that you find. And especially, I would say, jewelry. Jewelry is really popular there. It's usually silver in color. Silver is really popular. We wear these like very heavy necklaces. They're traditionally made out of silver, but nowadays they are mixing with different metals to, you know, make them lighter so they're not so heavy and just so that they're less expensive to purchase and make and buy. But just those traditional necklaces are actually very heavy and they're very, how do I say, complex. There's lots of different coils, like multiple layered coils and designs and symbols on there that make the necklace very heavy. My family has a couple that we share, and between my siblings, we share a couple because not everyone can afford to have their own because they're quite old, I'd say. They're kind of passed down in my family because my father made them way back in Laos, and Thailand, when they were in refugee camps. They made those and they brought them over. So my family still has those. But at the Hmong New Year, everybody dresses up in their best Hmong clothes. So they're wearing whatever their family makes. Sometimes if a family has a lot of daughters, they'll make them all matching outfits. So sometimes you'll see whole families with matching outfits. Even their sons will have matching outfits with the daughters, you know. So if a mother has, or just that family in particular, has enough time and skill and money to have matching outfits for their family, that's kind of a pretty big flex, I guess you'd say. I'd say people who are more traditional, they tend to have clothing that was passed down to them, such as my family. Most of my clothing that I have, my mother made for my sisters. And as they grew up, she made them new clothes, and then their clothing came down to me. And then I wear kind of their traditional Hmong clothing. But as I've gotten older, my mother's made me my personal own clothing, which is specifically like vests and belts that have very unique embroidery. And of course, she hand stitches all those on her own as well. She attaches the beads and the coins. And when we go to the Hmong New Year, the whole purpose for Hmong people, young Hmong people, or at least Hmong young people, I mean, there's lots of older Hmong people now that still are trying to enjoy the dating scene. When we go, we're actually looking to find a spouse there. So
it's a social occasion, but also one where you're looking to connect with someone, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. When you go to the Hmong New Year, there's actually a whole large section at the Fresno Fairgrounds. When you go, there's actually a large section of the area that's left completely open for people to go and actually connect, because we actually have this tradition called ba-ba, which is you actually have a ball and you ask someone, nowadays it's the man or the woman, but you ask a person that you're interested in to, if they want to play a game of tossing the ball, and you toss a ball between one another and you have to throw it underhand and you have to catch it overhand. And whoever drops the ball, you have to give the other person a belonging of yours. So that could be like a hairpin or a neck or like a ring or something from your pocket or a piece of your clothing. And the whole point of that is so that once the game ends, they have an incentive to come and find you, that, I have your shoe, or I have your necklace, or something like that. Uh-huh. And these games can get extensive, especially if someone isn't interested in someone and they repetitively drop the ball. These people can like lose both of their shoes. They can lose their jacket. They can lose their hat. They can lose, you know, like all these different kinds of things. And It is very funny because when you go and you do see these people partaking in this traditional, these young people still partake in this traditional tradition where you toss each other the ball, this game, and you see people standing without their shoes or without a hat or something, and the other person is holding their items because they're trying to ask them on a date, you know? So it kind of gives them an incentive to follow up on them and, like, kind of gives them an incentive to, even after the game ends, to talk to them and connect with them. So that's a really fun tradition that I think is very much still alive and I think is very fun. I've never had someone ask to play a game with me because they wanted to date me or anything. It was always a friendly game between me and another friend of mine just to play. And normally that is how it starts. You're usually just playing a game of tossing the ball with someone else, and then someone usually comes and asks to play with you instead. And this game can be between multiple people, not just two people. It can be between a large group of people, and the ball can go back and forth between this large group of people. And, you know, depending on who you were hoping to connect with, you just stand in front of that person and hope that you can toss the ball with them. And hopefully that they drop the ball.
What kind of foods are typically, available at these amazing gatherings?
At this one specifically, there's actually different kinds of foods.
Sure.
But all of the vendors sell typically the same type of food. And I think it was kind of out of an incentive to keep everything kind of equal.
Yeah.
But what's pretty popular is, like, you can find steamed fishes. Mm-hmm. You can find pork sausages. You can find, obviously, sticky rice. You can find papaya salad. You can find pho. You can find, I'd say a barbecued pork. Those are really popular.
So those are all kind of sort of foods that would have been available in your native country.
What I'm thinking is that I think about traditional Hmong food, it's a little different than the food that I would see here.
Yeah, tell me.
A lot of the food that we see here that we consider to be Hmong is actually adapted from the country where our family might have been or lived or been influenced by. So like Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, a lot of our food is inspired by that food here. But traditionally in Hmong culture, my family, like growing up, we ate pretty plain food, I'd say. We didn't have a lot of spices and we didn't have a lot of flavoring aspects to our food growing up. We mostly like I said, the Hmong culture was kind of self-sustaining. You know, they grew their own food, they raised their own animals, and they didn't have a lot of, spices that you can just have access to. That there wasn't a lot of trading that was done between the Hmong people that lived up in the mountains. So
it was a very, very simple diet.
Yes, it was a very simple diet, you know, simple starches, like roots.
So what were the mainstays of your diet?
Ooh, so
rice.
I know that definitely rice. If you could grow rice was definitely a main staple, but also things like starchy potatoes such as like a tapioca root.
Yes.
I think they call it yucca root as well.
Right.
We also had, you know, just yams, different types of yams, of course, and sweet potatoes.
What kind of animals were available? Were there any wild animals? I know you had certain domestic animals as well.
There were wild animals. I believe they also hunted like different types of wild pigs, different types of wild game birds. Specifically, when I visited Laos with my mother, they actually were able to hunt us a wild pig, and it was very gamey. It was very, very gamey.
Uh-huh.
But the way that they cook it is, again, it's very simple. They chop it up, they boil it, and they fry it. And that they salt it and that's about it. But it's still, the simplicity is also still a flavor, you know? It's sure. still very delicious just based on the simplicity of it. But I would say Hmong food, yeah. like you said, it is very simplistic. Yeah. But it's also still very hearty.
And one thing we've not really spoken about, you mentioned a lot about the designs that are sometimes rather simple, but I think I've also seen some rather elaborate designs that are representational or that do feature subject matter that one can at least either naturalistic or realistic. What's the basis for that?
Yeah, so for Hmong embroidery in particular, I know that a lot of it, when it comes to like for clothing and stuff like that, it was supposed to be pretty mm-hmm. ambiguous. There weren't always a lot of symbolism in it, but for certain specific items, I'd say there would be specific embroidery. So like a really specific one would be the carrying sash for babies that we have. We have these specific sashes that we carry babies with, and those have specific patterns on there, and they're supposed to kind of be very beautiful and colorful and kind of symbolizing flowers and whatnot, because, well, based on what my mother told me, why we do this is because it's supposed to ward off spirits. So when a woman is working out in the fields, you know, back in the day, you know, when they were self-sustaining, they'd have to carry their children with them. And when they carry them on their backs, babies are very susceptible to being taken, their spirits being taken from wandering spirits and evil spirits. And so having that embroidery on the sash that you're carrying your baby with, it was kind of a way of warding off spirits by making them mistake it for being flowers or just being some kind of like field of flowers. So it was kind of like a way of like warding off spirits. And so I feel
it was protection.
Yeah. So I feel like a lot of embroidery that is on a specific item, such as pillows or blankets or hats, I think those are kind of like symbolic for protection, you know?
Protection to ward off evil spirits and to somehow yeah. provide guardianship and elements that will allow people to live and thrive and be healthy and not be affected by any sort of
definitely
maleficent or negative consequences of the natural world.
We also have like jewelry that's like that as well. Like we have specific necklaces uh-huh. that will have like a specifically shaped pendant
uh-huh.
that is also supposed to ward off spirits. So I do believe.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, guess what? We used up our three segments, and we've just scratched the surface on Paku's wondrous sort of itinerary, the quick journey and some sound bites.
Definitely just the surface.
Just the surface. And I've so enjoyed this. I have to tell you, it's fascinating and wonderful to have this conversation. We've really not talked about these sorts of things together, and I find them to be endlessly engaging, and I hope you enjoyed our interaction today.
Definitely. It's really refreshing to, you know, let people know about my culture, so.
Yes. Is there any one thing that you would have to share about the Hmong people with our audience?
Well, I know that in more recent years, a lot of people have made the argument that Hmong people would say that Hmong means free. And I kind of feel like that kind of embodies the Hmong people because mm-hmm. the Hmong people have never really, they may have at one point in time, but based on just what I've learned so far is that Hmong people don't really have a homeland, as in most people would call a certain geographic location their homeland. Hmong people don't really have that. And I feel like there's kind of two sides to the Hmong culture that some people would argue that we need to have a homeland in order to be a collective kind of people. But there's also that one side that really believes that we don't need a homeland to be a connected kind of people. And I feel like I kind of lean towards that side that we don't need to have a geographic location to call a homeland to be a special kind of people.
Well, that's wonderful, Paku. Thank you so much for sharing with us the wondrous journey of your life and a taste of the Hmong culture.
Thanks, Alan.
You're most welcome. Okay, gang. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.